You are listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, a quantum reality check, as photon experiments imply that the wave function is real.
Oh, it's very exciting. It's really the first experiment that can completely rule out one class of those interpretations.
If you fell into a black hole, would you be spaghettified or set on fire? Neutrinos detected on Earth could provide the answer.
So this is a real possibility. And the reason for that is that if you replace this event horizon, which is imaginary surface at which nothing happens, with something, then it could actually light up. And that's basically as simple as that.
And what your network of friends on Facebook can tell you about the arrow of time.
It's kind of this notion in the back of my head where I said, okay, if I had this new theory of quantum networks, then I would want to go after some problems about emergence. And one of the oldest ones, and maybe the most important one, is, well, why does the classical world look like the classical world?
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster.
Welcome to the latest podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. That's, of course, assuming that the Foundational Questions Institute is real.
You think FQXI might just be an illusion, Brendan? Or some kind of nightmare?
I just can't help wondering what really exists at the fundamental level. I mean, weird things happen on quantum scales. Particles can be in two places at the same time. Heisenberg told us that we can never know precisely where an electron is and where it's going at the same time. When we carry out quantum experiments, we can't even know for certain what the outcome will be.
Yeah, well, that's why we have the quantum wave function, Brendan. The wave function is a mathematical thingamajig that we plug into equations so that we can calculate the probability of getting a certain result in a quantum test.
But what is this thingamajig actually, deep down? Suppose I hypothetically put Puffy the cat in a box with some poison that may or may not be released if a radioactive atom does or does not decay. Wait, Puffy, come back. It's just a thought experiment.
Right, yes. This is the paradox of Schrödinger's cat, or Foster's cat. Before you open the box, the atom has, in some sense, both decayed and not decayed.
The poison has and has not been released.
And Puffy the cat is both alive and, well, you know...
Yes, so okay, the wave function helps me calculate what I'm likely to find when I open the box. But does that really mean that the cat is both alive and existentially challenged inside the box? Or is the cat simply either dead or alive, and I just don't know which because I can't see? Does the wave function represent our uncertainty about the true state of reality? Or does the wave function correspond to reality itself?
Physicists have been debating different interpretations of quantum mechanics for decades, but in February, quantum physicists Martin Ringbauer and Alessandro Fedrizzi of the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia, and their colleagues published an experiment in Nature Physics that they claim strengthens the view that, assuming a notion of objective reality exists, the wave function is real. I caught up with Ringbauer and Fedrizzi earlier via Skype, and they kindly chatted to me about their experiments and what exactly they mean, despite some rather turbulent weather conditions, as Fedrizzi explains.
Let me just say that we're at the northern New South Wales coast at the workshop, and we're getting hammered by a Category 5 cyclone that's just coming in from the Pacific. So I'm just saying this, so it might be that the connection cuts out, then you know that we'll need rescue.
Oh, okay, right. I'll call the international rescue for you if you do disappear.
Excellent.
Right. Oh my goodness, this is even more dramatic than your paper possibly, but...
Yes.
But sure, let's start off. You know, you've written this very exciting paper in Nature Physics based on an experiment that you've carried out that, you know, looks at the reality of the wave function. You know, perhaps you can just tell us a little bit about, you know, why this is such an interesting topic and why you were interested in thinking about it.
I think everyone is interested in this question, really, and not just in science. I think all of us probably have at some point thought about, you know, what is it that is real? What is the universe made of, really? So at the quantum level, the wave function is really our best description of what happens, and it's the start of every calculation. And we have a pretty good idea how quantum systems evolve once you know what the wave function is. But the question really is, how does it connect to this reality that we're looking for? And so there is a number of opinions you can hold. So you can either think that there isn't any objective reality, so that, you know, every reality that we assign to a quantum state eventually after measurement is just subjective to whoever observed it. But there are also a large group of people who think that reality should be objective, so that, you know, independent of who measures it and how you measure it, it should give you the same reality in the end. And within that category of models, we can now decide what the wave function really represents.
So I guess, you know, the famous example, perhaps I should say, is the one of Schrödinger's cat. You know, you lock a cat in a box with some poison that will be released by a radioactive trigger mechanism. And when the box is shut and we don't know what's going on, that radioactive process may or may not have happened.
Yep.
The poison may or may not have been released, and the cat may be alive or it may be dead. And then we say this very sort of intriguing thing of, you know, before the box is open, the cat is both alive and dead at the same time. And so, you know, what does the wave function tell us? And then how would that, how might that relate to what's really out there?
Yeah. So as a cat person, I really struggle with. So the wave function really tells us that there is a superposition. It can be in a state of alive and dead at the same time. And the question is that, you know, if you believe in an objective reality, then a very popular explanation of what's going on with a cat is that the wave function, which describes the superposition of alive and dead, really just represents a lack of knowledge of what the cat's real state is at the moment. So, you know, the cat would be actually dead or actually alive. It's just we don't know what it is, and that's why we describe it as a superposition of alive and dead. And so as we open the box, we supposedly just reveal this objective reality, which was always there, and nothing strange is really happening. The other thing that could be happening is that the wave function directly corresponds to this underlying reality. And now that is a problem, because if the underlying reality is really alive plus dead, then we're really looking at a cat which is alive and dead at the same time. And so this is the viewpoint that our results sort of strengthen.
In 2012, theoretical physicists Matthew Pusey, Jonathan Barrett, and Terry Rudolph came up with a theorem, which has been dubbed the PBR theorem, based on their initials, that appeared to show that models that claim that the wave function represents our uncertainty about objective reality must be wrong. These models are called psi-epistemic, or knowledge models. But as Fedrizzi explains, their theorem had problems.
What kicked this off was this paper by PBR in 2012, where they tried to just write down a so-called no-go theorem, where they said, with this paper, we can essentially rule out all models in which the wave function just describes some limited knowledge. But it failed because there were a number of additional assumptions that they had to make. And there were a number of similar papers which also tried to write down no-go theorems, which also had additional assumptions. And so that's why people, and in particular some of our co-authors, so Cyril Branciard and Eric Cavalcanti, and of course others, why they sort of switched tactics and moved to trying to just put some numerical bounds on these knowledge models by looking at how well they explained quantum state overlap.
The quantum state overlap that Fedrizzi alludes to describes an ambiguity that can occur in the lab when you try to measure the property of, for example, a photon using a single measurement, leaving you uncertain about that property. To help illustrate the idea of an overlap in an everyday context, Martin Ringbauer uses a simple example involving two sets of playing cards.
So a classical example of this would be, take two decks of cards, where the one deck contains only aces and the other deck contains only red cards. Now, if you randomly draw a card and you happen to end up with the ace of hearts, then you cannot tell from which deck of cards it came from.
In their experiment, the team looked at the overlap between the states of polarized photons. When photons are polarized in completely different or orthogonal directions, such as vertical and horizontal, they can be distinguished and you will not see this kind of overlap. But if you prepare their polarizations in non-orthogonal directions, for instance, having some with a vertical polarization and some with a diagonal polarization, then you can end up with a similar situation such as was seen in the playing cards example, with an overlap when you carry out a single measurement. This overlap, Ringbauer explains, can make the two states indistinguishable by a single measurement.
Well, I mean, if you end up with the ace of hearts, then you can never tell where it came from, no matter how many measurements you make on that card. And that's the idea for why we should not be able to distinguish two non-orthogonal quantum states, because they overlap in a similar way as the decks of cards overlap. And every now and then, our preparation lab actually leads to the same objective reality. And then the two are exactly the same, so we cannot distinguish them.
Going back to the playing cards analogy, it's possible to calculate how often you should expect such an overlap to occur. If one deck contains 13 aces of each suit and the other contains red cards, then you'll get an overlap when you pick out any one of the 26 red aces from the ace pack. If when you test this, you find a greater level of ambiguity than this, then this uncertainty you observe cannot fully be explained by overlap alone, and the psi epistemic model fails. As Fedrizzi explains, his colleagues were similarly able to calculate how much overlap various psi epistemic models can explain in the case of photons. And this could be put to test in the lab.
And then they came up with some measures for what this overlap should be in the quantum world and what this measure should be in the classical overlap world, if you so want, in these epistemic models. And then they just tried to compare these two numbers, and they found that they don't agree with each other. And that's essentially what they then designed an experimental test for, and that's the test that we carried out. The overlap of these epistemic states could either fully explain why states are not distinguishable, or it can, for example, not explain it at all, or it can explain it a little bit. So there is a continuous range of how much this overlap could essentially explain. What these guys came up with is really an experimental test where you can just essentially measure where this boundary lies.
In their experiment, the team looked at a system of photons that had some extra properties beyond polarization and carried out measurements that allowed them to work out the amount of overlap in their system and compare this with the predictions of psi epistemic models. Here's Ringbauer.
From all these measurements, we then calculate some probabilities, and that gives us an estimate of how much overlap can be in a knowledge model for those states that we chose. So we compare this to the quantum overlap of those states that we can just calculate from standard quantum mechanics, and then we calculate the ratio. And whenever that ratio is below 1, we show that the knowledge interpretation cannot explain everything. And the further down we can get this ratio, the less can be explained.
Okay, so now you've carried out your experiment and you're trying to kind of push this boundary to see where exactly it lies. So what did you find?
And now in the experiment, we found a bound of 0.7 approximately. So we are fairly certain that maximal subsystemic models are not possible. And as we improve our experiment, we want to push this bound further down and eventually get close to zero.
We're talking here, you're sort of saying, well, we've ruled out this kind of maximally psi epistemic model.
Yeah, that's right.
But what's this kind of grey area in between where you say that, you know, you could have a psi epistemic model that's perhaps less maximal, that's non-maximal?
On the one end, we have the maximally psi epistemic interpretations that explain all of that indistinguishability in terms of overlapping epistemic states. On the other hand, we have psi-ontic models, which we call them, which means that the wave function is actually in direct correspondence with the reality of our quantum system. And in that case, there is absolutely no overlap. So from knowing the state of reality, you automatically know the wave function as well. And in those models, you need some other explanation. And that basically means that measurements can only give us limited information.
Okay, so going back to your kind of analogy with the playing cards, if it's 100% maximal psi epistemic model, then you'll say that the ambiguity comes because, you know, you can have a card which is the Ace of Hearts and it simply could have come from either bag and you can't tell which. But as we go to non-maximal models, then you would say, well, part of it is maybe the card could have come from one bag or another bag, but part of it is also that I don't have my glasses on, so I can't see very well what it is that I'm looking at. And so that also brings in some ambiguity. And that's a limit on my knowledge. Is it something like that? So you have to kind of bring in different explanations to try and explain the same level of confusion.
Yeah, it's something along those lines. So in a maximalist epistemic model, you could say you have the correct number of cards in both decks so that you can explain the indistinguishability of those quantum states that quantum mechanics tells you. And as you go to a psi-ontic model, basically the number of overlapping cards decreases. And eventually you have two decks that have no overlap anymore. And yeah, you have to take your glasses off so that you can still explain why you cannot distinguish those states.
So now maximally psi-epistemic models have been ruled out. I asked Ringbauer, what's left?
We rule out an important class of interpretations of quantum mechanics, and they are interesting because they would have allowed for very intuitive explanations for all those weird features of quantum mechanics. But there are still some interpretations that are available. And so, for example, you could either accept that the wave function is now actually real and corresponds to its objective reality, or you say there is no objective reality, or you can go even further and say there is not even a wave function. We don't even need the wave function. Just to point to one of your recent podcasts about Howard Wiseman explained a new interpretation where they just completely get rid of the wave function. So there are still some approaches out there, and we'll have to see how our experimental capabilities progress, and maybe we can rule out some more and actually narrow it down to a class of interpretations that are still possible.
But it does seem very, very exciting, I think. Also, just, you know, as you sort of say, as you're putting this emphasis on experiment, that for so long we've been thinking about these just in theoretical terms, and to be able to really do an experiment now, that's quite an incredible achievement.
Oh, it's very exciting. It's really the first experiment that can completely rule out one class of those interpretations.
Excellent, excellent. And should I ask you, do you have a favorite interpretation?
Yeah, it definitely gave us something to think about. I myself am not 100% decided. Certainly not psi-epistemic anymore.
This is Alessandro again. So when we give talks on this topic, we often ask for a show of hands and for the audience to decide what they actually think is their favorite interpretation. And Martin only just did this 2 days ago at our workshop here. Unfortunately, the largest show of hands is always for undecided. So, you know, 80% of the audience don't have any opinion at all, and apparently they're just in the shut up and calculate camp. For me personally, as an experimentalist, I sometimes tend to move with whatever my current experiment tells me. So at the moment, I certainly don't believe anymore in this sort of Einsteinian view of the world of these, you know, maximal knowledge models. But I also struggle to fully accept the psi-ontic models because, you know, they contain some of my least favorite interpretations like Bohmian mechanics and many worlds. So we'll see what the future holds, I guess. I think what we really need and what would be really very exciting would be some kind of test that distinguishes between is there a reality or is there no reality. So that would be the next exciting frontier, I think, for also for foundational physics.
Thank you to Alessandro Fedrizzi and Martin Ringbauer for explaining their experiment to Zia. If you visit the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find links to their Nature Physics paper and news articles about their work. We're also linking to an interview with quantum physicist Ian Durham from 2012, in which he explains the theoretical work by FQXI member Jonathan Barrett, along with Matthew Pusey and Terry Rudolph, that also examined the reality of the wave function. And you can listen to our interview with Howard Wiseman about the possibility that many interacting classical worlds exist.
And if, like these researchers, you enjoy questioning the foundations, then you'll be pleased to learn that FQXI has released a compilation of essays from our 2012 contest asking you which of our fundamental physical assumptions is wrong. The volume, published by Springer, collects together updated and slightly more technical versions of our winning essays.
The compilation of modified essays from our 2013 It From Bit or Bit From It contest is also on sale now. You'll find links to those on our site too. I want to say that rereading the essays now, away from the pressure of the contest, I appreciate even more how good those essays were.
Yeah, they really are. They're worth another look if you've seen them already, and if you haven't, then, you know, now's your chance. Now, February was a good month for physics, not just because it saw the publication of FQXI's first two books, but also because actor Eddie Redmayne won both a British Academy Award and an American Academy Award for his portrayal of Stephen Hawking in Theory of Everything. Congratulations, Eddie.
I like the way that you implied that winning the BAFTA is just as prestigious as winning an Oscar.
If not more so. But anyway, Hawking's early work on black holes is very much at the heart of our next item, which looks at the possibility of finding observational evidence that our understanding of black holes needs to be radically rewritten. To kick us off, I have a question for you, Brendan. Would you rather be stretched out like a strand of spaghetti until you break up into your constituent particles and then get crushed? Or would you prefer to be set on fire?
Is there a third option?
No third option, I'm afraid. One of those two miserable fates are what physicists currently believe would happen to an astronaut unlucky enough to fall into a black hole. But which one is right?
We're still talking about physics. I thought for a horrible moment that you'd been watching the 50 Shades of Grey movie and it had given you strange ideas. But yes, I see. We're talking about the black hole firewall debate. For decades, physicists thought they knew what was going on with black holes, those cosmic objects that form when some stars collapse. At the core of a black hole lies a singularity, a place where the laws of physics break down. Space-time is so curved inside a black hole that anything that approaches too close will be swallowed by it, even light. The point, or rather the surface, of no return is called the event horizon. Once you cross that, there's no coming back. You're doomed to death by black hole.
And the cruelest irony seems to be that if you did cross the event horizon, you wouldn't even notice. Because according to Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity, there's nothing particularly noticeable about this imaginary invisible surface. You would just keep drifting toward the singularity until, well, gravity's effects become too strong to ignore and you're spaghettified. Then eventually your remains would be crushed in the black hole's core.
Or at least that's what physicists thought until a couple of years ago when FQXI members Joe Polchinski and Donald Meroff, along with Ahmed Almeri and James Sully, looked more closely at the situation and came to a startling conclusion. If what we think we know about quantum laws is true, then actually this peaceful, invisible event horizon is replaced with a ring of fire.
On the bright side, at least the pain would be over quicker for the poor burning astronaut.
Physicists have been debating over which gruesome fate is the correct one for some time now. Many are reluctant to accept that firewalls are real because it goes against the predictions from general relativity that the event horizon is no different from ordinary empty space. If only there was some way to just look at a black hole and find out if firewalls are real or not. I mean, without me having to go out there and hurl myself into one. FQXI doesn't pay me enough to do that.
No, they really don't. It's funny you should say that, Brendan, because physicists Niyash Afshoudi and Yasemin Yazdi, both at the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, and the University of Waterloo, have carried out an analysis that suggests that you may be able to find observational evidence of the existence of firewalls by detecting neutrinos here on Earth. In fact, we've already spotted some mysterious neutrinos that could be attributed to black hole firewalls. Now, as I said, the seeds of this firewall debate were first planted by Stephen Hawking when he realised that black holes are not completely black. In the 1970s, he applied quantum mechanics to his analysis of black holes and calculated that, actually, some particles can slowly escape the black hole's grip, in what is known as Hawking radiation. I spoke with Afshordi earlier, and as he told me, quantum mechanics does not seem to respect the no-escape rule that classical physics says should be imposed at the event horizon.
The classical view is that nothing special happens at the horizon. But what's interesting is quantum mechanics doesn't quite respect the same notions of locality and no escape radius that we had from classical relativity. I think the simplest way that this is one way to describe this notion of Hawking radiation is that you could have, in fact, vacuum in quantum mechanics is not empty. There are always fluctuations of vacuum.
A key point here is that according to quantum mechanics, the vacuum is not empty. Instead, pairs of particles and antiparticles are continuously bubbling into existence for a fleeting moment before recombining with each other and disappearing. One way to think about Hawking radiation is to imagine what happens if one of these virtual particle and antiparticle pairs pops up just outside a black hole's event horizon. Here's Afshordi again.
So the particle can fall into the horizon and antiparticle could escape infinity or vice versa. This is in fact something that classically wouldn't happen because vacuum is empty in classical physics. But in quantum mechanics, these things could happen and it gives you a slow rate of evaporation for the black hole because particles can escape to infinity from the neighborhood of black holes. Of course, the energy should be conserved. So the energy or the mass of the black hole should decrease over time. This happens very, very slowly. It takes trillions and trillions of years for astrophysical black holes. But something that could happen in principle for black holes, and this is one of the consequences of this calculation of Hawking, that black holes aren't really black. Things can actually get out.
So if one of a pair of virtual particles falls into the black hole, the other can escape the event horizon as Hawking radiation, causing the mass of the black hole to decrease. Left for long enough, the black hole would eventually evaporate away completely. But this raises another problem. What happens to the information about the matter that the black hole has swallowed?
Hawking realized that this was an important question because according to quantum mechanics, information should not disappear entirely from the universe. There should be some way to retrieve it. Here's Afshordi again, describing what became known as the black hole information paradox.
In fact, this is something that goes back to Hawking himself. So there's this idea of information paradox that, I mean, if something collapses into a black hole, it has information. So it could be a blue star or a red star or a red giant or a natural neutron star. So there could be different types of things that collapse into a black hole. But then it would evaporate through something that looks very much like a thermal radiation. And it was a puzzle what happens to information, because all you get at the end is kind of bland soup of thermal particles that come out independent of whatever that goes in.
As Afshordi explained there, at first, it didn't seem like Hawking radiation could be carrying information out, because that radiation was thermal. A hot mess, you could say, without any real structure.
Nonetheless, over the years, physicists did try to work out ways that the Hawking radiation could sneak information out of the black hole, perhaps coded in the relationship, or entanglement, between various escaping particles.
For a while, that approach looked as though it could solve the problem. But when Polchinski, Meroff, Almeri, and Sully looked closely at the situation, they discovered that if information was being smuggled out of the black hole, the process would cause the event horizon to heat up, hence a firewall. There is some debate whether firewall strictly refers to the wall of fire or the computing firewall that protects sensitive information. In either case, it would violate general relativity's predictions. So general relativity would be wrong.
Now here's a funny thing. Physicists already know that general relativity breaks down at the core of the black hole. To describe the tiny but powerful singularity, we need to combine both general relativity, which describes regions of strong gravity, with quantum mechanics, which describes very small things, in one big theory of quantum gravity. So physicists already know that general relativity doesn't work in some places. Why, I asked of Shorty, are they so reluctant to accept firewalls? Is it because it means accepting that general relativity is wrong at the event horizon too?
Certainly, as a sociological assessment, it's very true that physicists are not happy, and I think the most conservative amongst us basically want to stick to classical physics as far as we can. That's how physicists are. Physicists are conservative by nature, and they're very skeptical of new ideas until there's really no way out. The fact, though, is we know general relativity is not complete. It's going to fail at some point. But then where is the place where general relativity fails? That's the thing that most people, or the most conservative amongst us, want to limit it to the neighborhood of singularity. And the most conservative approach has pros and cons. The pro of most conservative approach is that you don't have to modify your beloved general relativity on larger scales. The con is you have to give up some other principle, either information, whether information is lost or not through the evaporation of a black hole, or other principles that may not be as sacred as preservation of information, but nevertheless are kind of principles that we thought would never be violated in nature. So it's really a choice that you have to make. Some of us want to stick with the old principles, and some of us want to move on.
Right. Okay. So, you know, as you say, there's kind of this choice, you know, maybe we have to give up these ideas that have been built into general relativity, in which case we might accept that there's a firewall, or we say, well, there's no firewall, but maybe in that case, we can't have information being preserved in the way that we feel it should be based on our understanding of kind of quantum mechanics and quantum theory. But I guess, you know, one thing that would be really helpful is if people could just look and see if firewalls were there or they weren't. But for a long time, that seemed to be something that we'd never be able to check. We can't sort of go out there and throw something into a black hole and see if there's a firewall. But now I guess this is where your paper comes in, because you've sort of been thinking about this question in more of a kind of experimental observational way of saying, well, actually, instead of getting stuck in these kind of theoretical arguments of, you know, what choices do I have to make? Which principles do I prefer? Is there some way of seeing or observing whether a firewall is actually there?
Absolutely. So as physicists, we want to ask nature rather than each other what's the right thing to do. So this is a real possibility. And the reason for that is that if you replace this event horizon, this is imaginary surface at which nothing happens, with something, then it could actually light up. And that's basically as simple as that.
So according to Afshordi's calculation, if firewalls exist, they could light up in a way that we could see. To explain how, Afshordi likens the event horizon, assuming that there's something physically there, like a firewall, to Earth's atmosphere being struck by meteors and comets.
So the question then was, could they light up as they hit the fireball? So that's certainly a possibility. There is no reason that wouldn't be the case. And this is something that, in fact, has been tested by one of my colleagues, that it could, for example, a black hole at the center of our galaxy light up as material fall onto it. We actually can see the black hole at the center of the galaxy very well. And the answer is no, it doesn't light up. We can actually look at the stuff that come out of the horizon and we don't see much.
As Afshordi explains, in the case of firewalls, this energy may not be given off only as photons of light, but also in the form of elementary particles known as neutrinos.
There's one thing that you don't necessarily see this in as photons, as electromagnetic radiation. It also could come out as neutrinos, and that was an insight that we had. So in principle, that would be an observational signature. As the material falls into these fireballs, they could light up, and they could emit neutrinos.
So we have these detectors in place. As you say, we've seen neutrinos from a supernova. We have the ice cube detector, you know, in the South Pole that's set up to look for very, very distant neutrinos, or neutrinos that are coming in from very distant sources.
Mm-hmm.
Have we seen any possible signs of a firewall yet?
So the answer is that it's possible within a reasonable range of parameters that the neutrinos that we see, the very high energy neutrinos that we see from ice cube. I guess one of the problems with them is that we don't really have a good model to explain them from the usual conventional astrophysics. And if you exhaust all conventional ordinary explanations, then you have to look for exotic explanations like firewalls. But I think right now my only answer would be it's possible. It's a possible origin for these extremely high energy neutrinos that are observed. But there are other possibilities, so I guess we have to wait and see.
When you say that there are other, you know, perhaps more conventional explanations for the neutrinos, what sorts of things might those be?
For example, you could have gamma ray bursts. There could be a supermassive black hole. It could also be just cosmic rays across different galaxies in the universe. So these are the kind of possibilities.
Okay, so we have these mysterious neutrinos, and we have sort of a conventional set of possible solutions for them, but none of those quite fit perfectly. Maybe it's firewalls, maybe it's not, but we're going to wait and see.
Right, the proposal is that let's try to see whether there might be neutrinos coming from the neighborhood of that horizon. And there might be none, but that also teaches us something about the black holes. And that's the real mystery. These are the most bizarre things we have that currently live in our universe. Let's try to understand them.
So there we have it. Black holes are bizarre, but there may be a way of getting to grips with what's going on by looking for neutrinos coming off of them at detectors on Earth.
And we have already spotted some strange neutrinos that can't easily be explained by more conventional sources. That doesn't mean that they are definitely created by firewalls, but it is an intriguing possibility.
On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you can read Afshorty and Yazdi's paper. We're also pointing you to a blog post by FQXI member Sabine Hassenfelder, who praises the pair for attempting to relate the problem to observations, but who also analyzes the paper in some depth and questions its relevance to firewalls specifically. And for a popular account of the firewall problem, there's a link to an article that Zia wrote for Nature.
Phew, that took a lot of explanation.
Well, this whole topic is extremely involved and convoluted with lots of twists and turns. Perhaps we should provide an in-depth series of podcast specials, a serial, if you will, explaining the ever-evolving controversies around black holes. If you'd be interested, then let us know by emailing us at podcast@fqxi.org or on Twitter @FQXI.
Now, on the subject of social media, what does our network of friends on Facebook or Twitter have to do with the passage of time?
Oh, I know this one. Is it that my life slowly drips away as I spend hours online watching the vastly more entertaining lives of my friends as I grow steadily older?
Yes, there is that. But also, social networks, and the World Wide Web itself, among other things, are the subject of complex network theory, which examines interconnectedness. Now, FQXI member and physicist Jacob Biamonti at the Institute for Scientific Interchange in Torino in Italy and colleagues are establishing a quantum theory of complex networks. In doing so, the team hopes to examine how the classical world we see around us, complete with time's arrow, emerges from the fuzzy and uncertain and time-symmetric quantum realm, as Biamonti explained to reporter Corinne Pickemer.
Some days it seems there are not enough hours in the day to keep up with all the demands on our time. You need to prepare a talk, deal with that review that has been on your desk for ages, and also find time to get across town to attend a long and almost certainly boring meeting. And you might really wish that you could be in more than one place at the same time. If only we were quantum particles, we really could be in two places at once. The quantum world is governed by laws that seem inherently odd and improbable to us, yet physicists have long been convinced that these laws underlie everything in nature. The question of how the world that we live in emerges from the quantum world remains one of the most fundamental and mystifying conundrums in physics. Now, a group of researchers based in Torino in Italy and led by FQXI awardee Jacob Biamonti are among a growing number of physicists who are addressing this by trying to tie together the scientific field of complex network theory with quantum mechanics. Biamonti enthusiastically told me about their research and the huge potential the new field has. He started off by explaining the evolution of the new field.
Towards the end of the last century, you know, quantum information was born. And around the same time, there was a really disconnected topic, which was complex network theory. For some long period of time, people just said, okay, you know, there's some random feature kind of governing these networks. And then people started to look at it and say, okay, well, how are, you know, let's take the transportation network, or let's take the phone network. What relationship is there with the connections? And what they found was they have this thing called the rich get richer. If you have $1 million, you're a million times more likely to get an extra dollar than someone who only has a dollar. So you have a network, and there's a node in it with many connections. If another node is going to enter that network, it's highly likely to connect to this node.
It's easy to see how this might work in social networks as well. The more friends that you have in your social network, the larger your pool of potential friends that you can connect with through these friends. This discovery that networks are not as random as previously thought turned out to apply to a wide range of networks and is one of the defining features of network theory.
Things that we're doing is we're saying, okay, what are the ideas from this field of science that's based on statistical mechanics? What are ideas in quantum mechanics that can let us develop a new theory of networks, which is based on quantum physics from first principles? And of course, how does that deal with the existing theory of networks? How does that deal with applications in the biological sciences, even outside of quantum physics?
But let's back up a little bit first. While quantum mechanics has been extremely powerful in explaining the world at the very small scales, it is not so easy to see how it governs the world that we live in. Biamonti explains.
Complex systems is all about seeing the forest, but you're locally, when you look around, all you see is trees. It's kind of this notion in the back of my head where I said, okay, if I had this new theory of quantum networks, then I would want to go after some problems about emergence. And one of the oldest ones, and maybe the most important one, is, well, why does the classical world look like the classical world? But the world that we're living in is really quantum. So you have this idea of the forest that's emerging, it's classical, but the trees, the real small little entities, those are quantum.
Physicists have spent many years trying to figure out how they can bridge the gap between the quantum and classical worlds, but so far, frustratingly, they have not been successful. Now, Biamonti and others are optimistic that by combining the two fields, quantum information science and complex network theory, we might be able to address questions about emergence and just generally begin to understand our world better.
If you have a big field of science such as complex network theory and quantum information science, and on the one hand, quantum information science, what it's really about is about using the inherent complexity of nature as a tool, as a resource. And then you have complex network theory, which is about understanding complexity. And it's interesting because there's a lot of parallels between these two ideas, but there's been very little work that's kind of tried to merge these fields together by creating a new theory of networks, which is based on quantum physics. Right now, we're at a time period where a lot of people are trying to unify physics, but there's a lot of other areas of science that are not unified at all. Okay, so we don't know the relationship between all these different types of network theory. This is actually quite interesting because there's really a lot out there and there's really some confusing things out there. So if you look at, you know, these diagrams that they draw in biology, okay, there's various different types of network theory, and these are reminiscent of electrical circuits, but they have kind of their own language. That's one of the things that we're kind of directions that we're going towards, is to sort of understand the mathematical structure behind those. And then once we understand that, we can actually put down some things concretely that would say that there's a difference between this type of network theory and the types of networks that arise in quantum theory.
Biamonti and his colleagues have already taken first steps towards this goal and have used quantum information theory to look at the difference in the way time behaves in quantum and classical worlds. On the microscopic level, there does not appear to be any arrow of time. Reactions and processes could just as easily occur backwards as forwards. This is known as time reversal symmetry. Physicists do not understand why, at the macroscopic level, time as we perceive it is asymmetric. A little bit of history first.
One of the things that we've been looking at in regards to this network theory is, how does time reversal symmetry come into play? You can actually come up with some methods and also some rigorous ideas about how you can direct a particle on a graph using a time-independent method for control that just involves symmetry breaking.
Graphs are common tools used in complex network theory. In the 18th century, the Swiss mathematician Leonhard Euler created a map to solve the Königsberg Bridge problem. The problem was to work out whether it was possible to walk through the town crossing each of the 7 bridges that connected 2 islands to the mainland of the city once and once only. The resulting schematic was possibly the first known depiction of a graph. The nodes in the graph show the bridges and the lines, or the edges as they are technically called, between them, the route that had to be taken. Since then, graphs have been used extensively to try to understand all sorts of processes and systems, and we come across them all the time. A more contemporary example of a graph is the entire World Wide Web, in which the web pages are the nodes and the lines between them the links. Graphs form an important tool in network theory, so might it be that they also become a powerful new tool in quantum information theory?
The standard way to think about quantum mechanics acting on a graph is you have nodes, which are the location of a particle. And the particle has no other information, it has no internal degrees of freedom, what they call spin. Okay, it just is a point particle, and it can jump on this graph. And the way that it's jumping on that graph is governed by the Schrödinger equation. And the edges of that graph will be some kind of interaction strength, okay, which will give you a term in a Hamiltonian.
A Hamiltonian is a function corresponding to the entire amount of energy in a system.
Those terms are typically considered to only have to only induce time symmetric evolutions. Okay, and what you can do is you can actually replace them with a complex jumping term. And then you can have this particle jump, and you'll find that on certain graph topologies, it's impossible to break time reversal symmetry. So breaking time reversal symmetry turns out to actually inherently be a property of a graph that involves its global topology. What we found was that you can actually control and direct the motion of a particle by just putting it on a graph with specific edge weights, where you don't change the magnitude of the edge weight, you just change the complex number associated with those edges.
But as so often happens in science, there was an added, unexpected bonus, which might have quite important practical implications for building quantum computers.
In the process, we ended up putting this theory of time reversal symmetry into the language of quantum information science, which was maybe one of the first times this has been done, as far as we know. And now people are looking, looking at this from a foundational physics perspective to say, okay, what does time reversal symmetry really have to do with quantum information? And then there's many different questions and many different directions that we can take. There's definitely, I think, a good study that could be done that involves looking at the algorithmic potential of time asymmetry. And in that light, we did do a little bit of research on that. We found that many of the quantum circuits or quantum networks that are found in quantum algorithms do break time reversal symmetry, but we also showed that you could have a quantum computer that is fundamentally time symmetric, that could still model any other quantum computer. So that just means that it's a resource, but it's not something that you necessarily have in order to have a quantum algorithmic speed up.
Biamonti and his colleagues are still at the very early stages of their research, and as so often when new fields are born, lots of hurdles still need to be taken. Increasing numbers of physicists are realizing the possible applications of quantum networks to disciplines as diverse as medicine or computing. But Biamonti's own personal goal, while staying close to the physics, is no less ambitious. He wants to shake the very roots of the subject by trying to understand what happens when the forest emerges from the individual trees.
I think that, having a better theory of networks and really understanding the difference between theories of networks that are not quantum and theories of networks that are quantum is going to be important for the foundations of physics. And I really hope that we can go after the measurement problem or something else that has been one of those little nasty aspects of quantum physics that no one really got to the bottom of. I hope that these tools can sort of shine a little bit of new light on that, because a lot of these questions are questions that are reminiscent, at least, of questions that have been answered in complex systems to a reasonably satisfactory manner. And I think that's one of the things in my own future, is I would like to try to apply this stuff to that topic.
That was Jacob Biamonti talking with Corinne Pikema. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find a link to an article by Corinne exploring Biamonti's research in more detail. You can also listen to another podcast interview on complexity with Raisa D'Souza, who is flipping things around and applying techniques usually used for understanding microscopic physics, to help predict financial markets, the spread of disease, and Facebook friendship patterns. And an interview with Jeffrey West, who's predicting the end of civilization.
Which seems like a good place to close this edition of the podcast.
Thank you once more to Alessandro Fedrizzi, Martin Ringbauer, Niaya Shafshorty, Jacob Biamonte, and Corinne Bikema. And thank you for listening.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.
Right, now, I'm off to jump into a black hole.
And I'm going to let my life slowly ebb away on Twitter.
Well, that was cheery.